Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, local Republican Congressman Devin Nunes is at the center of a national political firestorm in Washington. What does it mean for his reelection? We'll talk about the Nunes memo and get an update on the latest political news and views with political scientist Jeff Cummins. We'll also find out why the endangered Delta smelt didn't bounce back after last year's wet winter ended California's drought. And we'll talk with the woman who hopes to become Madera County's next district attorney, Sally Moreno. We begin, though, up in the foothills. This month marks the 170th anniversary of the discovery of gold at Sutter's Mill. The legacy of the California Gold Rush is ever present in Northern California, especially in Mariposa County. It's visible in mining museums, at roadside historical sites, and in county buildings on Bullion Street. What hasn't persisted in this region is commercial gold mining itself. But as FM 89's Kerry Klein reports, one Canadian company wants to change that.
Sam Long works on a few thousand acres in the Mariposa County foothills. He doesn't have to go far to be reminded of the gold rush.
We've recovered, you know, old wheelbarrows, old shovels and picks, steel lunchboxes, old ore carts.
170 years later, he's here to reignite this historic industry. He's the exploration manager for Fremont Gold Mining, a small company prospecting for gold on a hillside overlooking Lake McClure. Inside a warehouse, geologists are examining rock samples, and outside, another is cutting rocks with a saw.
Ultimately, the goal is to have a mine and create good jobs for people throughout the county, throughout the state.
Fremont Gold's property lies along the famed Mother Lode Gold Belt, which stretches 120 miles from Mariposa County north into El Dorado County. Since the 1840s, it's been home to hundreds of gold mines that have extracted millions of ounces of the mineral. By some estimates, however, literal tons of gold still lie buried here. Fremont Gold thinks it has what it takes to make those potential resources a reality, though history suggests they're likely to have an uphill battle.
So this is a diamond drill rig, and what they're doing is they're actually drilling into the ground and recovering the drill core.
To be clear, Fremont Gold Mining is not actually mining. It's exploring. Its job is to determine how much gold its property contains, which involves surveying, sampling, and drilling. After exploring a quarter of its property, the company estimates it's already defined close to 900,000 ounces of gold, far more than what was already extracted during 100 years of mining on the property. So if so much gold remains in the hills here, exploration companies must be stampeding back to the mother lode, right? Nope. Throughout the five counties containing the gold belt, only one gold mine is active, and only intermittently. Other exploration projects have folded too. John Klinkenbeard with the California Geological Survey says that's because the mineral itself is only one component.
Gold production increases and decreases with the price of gold and with the economy and with wars, and a whole lot of things influence what happened.
Although the price of gold has dropped from its peak in 2012, after inflation, it's still about 2.5 times higher than its value in the 1840s. But gold operations themselves have become much pricier since then, with more advanced technology and higher labor costs. Vishal Gupta is CEO of California Gold Mining, the Canadian company that owns Fremont Gold. He says another reason gold mining slowed is this is California, ground zero for environmentalism.
I wouldn't say there was a moratorium on any gold mining since the Second World War, but it had become increasingly difficult for gold and other commodity based companies to do any sort of a business within the state.
Pat Perez of the State Department of Conservation says that's for good reason. In the 19th century, long before the California Environmental Quality Act and the Surface Mining and Reclamation Act, environmental accountability wasn't a thing.
You simply mined, and then when you were done, you walked away, and you left the land with significant scars and, in some cases, in environmental challenges and public hazards.
Mariposa County officials who handle local permitting are well aware of those scars. Associate planner Steve Engfer points to many practices he hopes are in the past.
Hydraulic mining, where they would mine whole mountainsides and all the silt and everything just washes downstream. River amalgamation processes.
He believes with diligence, gold mining can be both environmentally responsible and a driver of economic growth. But county resident Les Overstreet isn't convinced either is true. He lives a few miles away from the Fremont Gold site. He worries about how a mine could strain local infrastructure and water.
What's going to happen environmentally to the wild and scenic Merced River and then also the lake?
Our ore rock, is quartz veins, which are generally...
Fremont Gold expects to spend another few years drilling and surveying. If they do move forward with a mine, Long and Gupta say they have no plans to carry on the Gold Rush era's environmental legacy. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Sean Hannity has called its contents worse than Watergate. California Congressman Ted Lieu took a different approach, comparing it to Geraldo Rivera's anticlimactic opening of Al Capone's vault on live television. I'm talking, of course, about the so-called Nunes memo, written by Tulare Congressman Devin Nunes, chair of the powerful House Intelligence Committee. Nunes has been one of the most unlikely national figures of the last year. That's also made him an election year target, not just locally, but on a national level. So what does this national story mean here in the Valley? Joining us now is Fresno State political science professor Jeff Cummins. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We'll get into the nuances of the Nunes memo itself in just a bit. But before we do that, just some context on the way his role has played out in the last year in the House Intelligence Committee and the committee itself and its actions. High profile in the news on just about every day, it seems, in this issue of Russian interference in the election. And the divide between Democrats and Republicans on an intelligence committee, is that significant, or is there precedent for this type of partisan rancor in an intelligence capacity?
No, I think I would say that it is significant because we've been going through these partisan battles here really since the early 1990s is when we saw the split really take off. And of course, we're well aware now that it's very nasty in terms of the partisanship. But one thing that was always a constant throughout that was that when it came to national security, intelligence, and defense, usually there was bipartisan agreement on how we should approach these issues. And I would say that at least in recent recollections, I cannot think of a more partisan battle that has taken place on the Intelligence Committee, and it's a committee that has traditionally not been politicized. So I would, definitely say that this is significant and unprecedented.
Now, there's also a national narrative out there that Congressman Nunes is not up to the task or is overmatched. Sometimes, I guess you could say one of the characterizations might be sort of a country bumpkin. That's not my characterization, but what I've seen out there. Are those critics underestimating what Nunes is doing?
Well, I don't think it does any good to throw those characterizations out there. I think if you kind of step back and look at the overall context of what Nunes has done, he certainly has a penchant for gaining national attention and inserting himself into these very controversial issues. You can recall that early on when his committee was investigating the connection between Russia and the 2016 presidential election, how he famously did the midnight run where he took this information that the Obama administration had been surveilling some of his staff, or at least they had been swept up in the surveillance that was done. He you know, does this really strange thing where he goes to President Trump as soon as he finds out this information. That was really, really unprecedented, especially when you're the head of the committee that is looking into these connections between the president and Russia. So that was one very strange act. Of course, that led to his stepping down and an ethics investigation, which he was later cleared of. So, you know, just that one act alone is enough to raise questions about where his loyalties lie, I would say. And then we have this second incident now where, you know, you step back and look at the larger picture of someone who served on Trump's transition team. We already have this first midnight run strange act. We have the second thing where he writes a memo and essentially confirms, if you want to say that, you know, this was first brought up on Sean Hannity's radio show or shows, that there's a conspiracy going on in this Russia investigation against Trump, that the FBI and Department of Justice were against Trump from the very beginning. But then it's a classified memo that can't be released and nobody can really see it, you know, outside of a few House intelligence. It's really, you know, just strains the credibility, I would say, of what he's doing when you look at the larger picture.
So let's go ahead and talk about the memo itself. According to the New York Times, and the memo itself has not been publicly released, although members of Congress and now the FBI have apparently seen it. According to the Times, at least part of the memo alleges that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein signed off on a secret surveillance request to the FISA court involving surveillance of Trump aide Carter Page, at least in part using information from the infamous Steele dossier, which was created by opposition research firm Fusion GPS and paid for by the Clinton campaign. Democrats are rejecting these assertions as either inaccurate or overblown. What if there is some evidence of either wrongdoing or mistakes made in this process? I understand Speaker Ryan has some comments on that today. How do you interpret that?
Well, I mean, I think that I just, you know, on first blush, I don't see a lot wrong with it. Rod Rosenstein, that is his job to approve these applications. Now, remember, these applications still have to go before a judge to determine whether or not there's enough evidence to put, in this case, Carter Page, and then there are other applications as well, under surveillance. So it's not as if Rod Rosenstein was authorizing the surveillance. It still has to go through the judicial process to make sure that there's enough evidence to do this. And I don't think there's a lot there. It's from my perspective, I tend to agree with those that this is just a big smoke screen to try and distract from the larger Russia investigation. And I don't think we can emphasize enough that this investigation is extremely, extremely important, and that we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that everybody agrees, including Republicans, that Russia meddled in our elections. That alone is a very serious charge. And then there's the possibility that you have a presidential candidate, now president, possibly involved. That's very serious. And I think that this memo has been very effective at distracting us from that larger, much more serious issue.
Is it significant, though, that Speaker Ryan didn't try to distance himself from the memo, but tried to draw a line between the Russia investigation and this matter?
No, I think, you know, we got the reports today that Speaker Ryan had a meeting with House Republicans and basically said for them not to put too much credence in this memo and not get carried away with what is in it. And I think that's pretty significant. I think that's at least a little indicator that he thinks what is in there is not everything that's being made of it by Nunes and other Republicans that he's trying to tamp down these expectations that this is just going to, you know, blow up the Russia investigation and, you know, we're going to change directions on it. You know, and I would say, and one of the things about these partisan battles is trying to navigate who to believe and who not to believe. And one of the things that I tend to look to is what are, you know, the fellow partisans saying. In this case, it's Speaker Ryan. You know, of course, everybody's going to pay attention to what he says. So I tend to give a lot of weight when the co-partisans, right, the people who are on the same side of, in this case, these allegations, are saying, actually, let's tamp down the expectations here. And, you know, it's not everything that everybody's saying.
Is it significant also that the Nunes memo, whatever is in it, and again, we haven't seen it publicly yet, is itself not a primary source document? It's a memo written by Nunes about other intelligence or information that it's likely we will not see.
Oh, absolutely. I think that makes a lot of difference. That's what Adam Schiff, the Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, was saying, that it's misleading. They didn't interpret everything. They left out parts. And let's you know, go back to what is at stake here is that, you know, supposedly the FBI relied on this dossier from this Democratic paid opposition researcher. I think his name's Christopher Steele, if I remember correctly. That, of course, the FBI is going to, if this is information that's available to them on this Russian investigation, of course they're going to take it under consideration. Now, the question is that the only thing they relied on? You know, I don't think we would expect them to ignore it, but certainly it wouldn't be the only piece of information that they rely on to then do surveillance on President Trump's campaign staff, and that's what Democrats are saying. It wasn't the only piece of information that the FBI was relying on to conduct this investigation.
Or if in some way the FBI corroborated some of the information in the dossier. Moving on to the political angle here, let's say that this does go forward, as some of the president's critics say he might use this as pretext to dismiss Rod Rosenstein from at the FBI. How does this play in the local politics of this congressman, Devin Nunes? He's in what's normally thought of as a safe district, but if this continues to escalate, is there a risk that he has to be careful with not getting too tied to the Trump administration, or is that a foregone conclusion, that boat has sailed?
Why?
He's tied to Trump no matter what.
Yeah, I think there is definitely a risk for Congressman Nunes that this possibly, you know, let's just say for speculation's sake, that President Trump does fire Rod Rosenstein. And one thing I would point out here is that Rosenstein was an appointee of President Trump and confirmed by Senate Republicans, right? So this is your own guy, essentially, if you want to, you know, frame it that way, that you're then firing. And I think it's another piece of evidence that we can use that possibly President Trump is trying to cover something up here, and it will potentially inspire more voters within Congressman Nunes' district to go to the polls in the upcoming elections.
I want to go to that. Now, there was a poll released by Public Policy Polling, which is a Democratic polling organization that came out in mid-January, showing Nunes against a generic Democratic opponent and putting Nunes at 50%, the generic Democrat polling at 45%. Should we really pay any attention to that sort of poll right now? Again, it was released by also the campaign of Andrew Jans, who's one of the candidates seeking to challenge Nunes. Is this something that's really credible at this point?
I think it's credible. It's something we don't want to ignore, but I think we should also view it with some caution, particularly, you know, the fact that it's coming from Nunes's potential challenger. It's one poll, you have to remember. But I think it's definitely an indicator that, and this is what we expected with what has taken place with Congressman Nunes, with the Midnight Run and the, kind of this other these other controversial matters that he's been a part of, that we would expect that the race should be closer in this Republican, you know, lopsided district. So I think if we have a couple of more polls, maybe from other polling organizations that show this, that, yeah, it's going to be a very close race in.
Before we go, what will it take for national Democrats to start dropping money into this race? What should we look for there?
I mean, I think if Congressman Nunes's name stays out there and this memo kind of falls flat on Nunes, and we have some more polls that come out that show that this race is tight, I think you'll definitely see them start dumping money into the district. The race is already on the radar of the, you know, election prognosticators. So I think it's already out there, and National Democratic Party is just looking for more signs that this is a worthwhile race to dump their money into.
All right, Fresno State political science professor Jeff Cummins talking about the Nunes memo and the local political fallout. Stay with us. We'll be back with more on Valley Edition. We'll talk to Sally Moreno, candidate for Madera County District Attorney, and find out why she says she should replace current District Attorney David Lynn. That's coming up here on Valley Edition. The 2016-2017 water year was one of the wettest on record in California. While all that water in the system was enough to officially end the state's drought, its impact on endangered species is another story, especially when it comes to the Delta smelt. Joining us now is one of the state's leading experts on the issue, UC Davis Professor Emeritus Peter Moyle. Dr. Moyle, welcome.
Thank you.
So to the layperson, one might think that last year might have been a good year for the Delta smelt with so much rain and snowfall. Is that borne out by the data?
Unfortunately not. I was actually hoping it would be, because in 2011, the last time we had a fairly wet year, the smelt did rebound a bit, but they just failed to do it this year. And there are a couple of things going on here. One is that the numbers are so small, we might not have detected any increase, even if it occurred. But it really looks like they simply, their crash just continued.
How many fish did you find this year in your survey at the end of the 2017 calendar year?
Well, there are a whole bunch of different surveys that go on out there looking specifically for Delta smelt and generally sampling other fish. My own surveys in the Delta and in Sault Ste. Marie produced zero fish. The standard survey that everybody tends to look at is the Fall Midwater Trawl Survey run by the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And that one is a three-month survey with hundreds of trawls. They caught just two fish. And that was the record low number.
I want to repeat that. Just two fish in that survey? How does that compare to other years?
Well, during really good years that you had in the 1970s and 80s, it would have gotten hundreds of fish in that trawl program. And in recent years, it's been down, you know, in the 10, 15, 5 range, you know, very low numbers, but not as low as this year. And part of it is just that there's so few fish out there, they're just hard to catch. So there's a certain random component to the sampling.
Do biologists have an idea of how large the population might be? Obviously, if you found two fish, it doesn't mean that there are only two fish in existence in the wild, but do you have an idea maybe of how many fish are extant among the Delta smelt species?
Well, there are various surveys going on out there trying desperately to estimate numbers. The current number that's thrown out there by the fish agencies is around 4,000 fish are present. But you have to remember, this is a huge system. These are very small fish, and they're so difficult to catch that if you say there's 4,000 fish out there, it's 4,000 plus or minus 3,000 fish. So the number is very shaky, but it's a low number, whatever it is.
So you use the word crash when talking about the decline in Delta smelt numbers. Tell me a little more about that. Is this sort of a spiral issue, as we often see in some other instances outside of fish biology?
Well, the Delta smelt numbers have been, you know, they really got especially low in the last 20 years. And then in the last 10 years, they've reached such low numbers that it's hard. I guess it's hard to call it a crash because the numbers are so low you can't really detect it, but the numbers have been remarkably low. And that leads to speculation as to, well, can they really survive in the future because there's so few fish out there?
I want to follow up with that. What would be necessary, in your opinion, as one of the leading experts on this, for smelt populations to in some way rebound? Is it as simple as more water in the system, or is this far more complex at this point?
Well, more water in the system certainly would help, and that's always the issue. The problem is when and where. And the problem is there's so few smelt out there, and you might not be able to respond anymore. Every year, there's one or two additional things that are affecting the smelt. For example, the summer temperatures can get too warm, as they were last summer for much of the delta. There are invasive species that are eating the delta's smelt food supply. There's another invasive Japanese smelt out there that may be hybridizing with the delta smelt. So there are lots of other things affecting the smelt, unfortunately. And especially when numbers are low, it's very hard to separate out the various causes of decline.
Tell me more about that last bit with the invasive species from Japan. I have not heard that reported on before. What's going on there specifically?
Well, there's a smelt that was introduced from Japan in the 1950s, actually, into the California reservoirs to use as a forage fish. And it's finally made its way down into the delta. Actually, it's been down there for a while, but its numbers in recent years seem to have been expanding. And the genetic studies have been showing that it's breeding with the delta smelt, but it's quite likely that the hybrids between the two species are sterile, so it's not doing any population any good. And that's just one of these things that constantly happens as new threats develop.
So this has been remarked upon in many occasions, but what is the significance for the decline and ultimate, as you said, crash of the delta smelt population to the overall ecosystem? Why are biologists so concerned about this beyond just the existence of this species?
Well, in fact, species existence is the main reason. You know, under the Endangered Species Act, the official policy of the American people essentially is not to allow a species to go extinct. But when I first started studying the smelt, which is in the 1970s, it was a very abundant fish and probably fairly important to the ecosystem dynamics as a prey, as a predator on plankton and so forth. Since its decline, really since the 1980s, it's been so rare that it just hasn't been a very important part of the ecosystem.
Speaking of the rest of the ecosystem, with last year being a bad one for the delta smelt, what about other species? What about other endangered species in the delta? Salmon, other fish populations, are they seeing similar declines as the smelt, or did they experience the last year in a different way?
Well, some species did seem to have a slight upswing. The longfin smelt, for example, which is also listed as endangered, showed a slight upswing in its populations. Not very big, but enough to be a little more optimistic about it. There are other species that depend on freshwater outflow that are better indicators, like the striped bass, for example. Even though it's a non-native species, it's really completely adapted to our system. Now, striped bass numbers went up. And there are a number of things like this that are indicators that suggest that more water in the system definitely helps. But the problem is when you get down to these endangered species, numbers are so low, it's very hard to tell what's affecting the population.
I hear some people remark that bass and other predators could affect the delta smelt population. Is that something that is borne out by your research?
No, just the opposite, especially for striped bass, which are generally cast as a villain in this. They're actually, to me, a positive thing because they're such a good indicator of delta conditions. But when a species like the delta smelt is rare, the predators aren't interested in it because they just can't find it. What the striped bass, for example, like prefers is threadfin shad, which is another non-native species which feeds on plankton. And so the predators are opportunistic. They go for the abundant fish. They don't go for the rare ones.
As we close, there's so much right now on this issue of water in California that's on the statewide debate, the national debate, of course, the Twin Tunnels project that is currently being reviewed and possibly revised by the state, perhaps reduced to one tunnel. We'll see what happens there. And then also the Trump administration is now holding hearings in regards to its plan to increase water pumping from the Delta. What would your message be to regulators and leaders in Congress or in Sacramento about this latest data that you have?
Well, I think the basic message is that you do need to consider the Delta as an ecosystem. And consider not only these endangered species, which we're supposed to be protecting, but consider the fisheries. The salmon fisheries, for example, very much depend on having a healthy delta, or a delta that has the right attributes that, so that they can support them. So the basic message is look to the ecosystem and find ways to restore habitat as well as flows, and try to find the right conditions that many different species of fish and birds and other things can benefit from.
Peter Moyle is a UC Davis professor emeritus and one of the state's leading experts on the delta ecosystem. He joins us today on Valley Public Radio. Dr. Moyle, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome, Joe. Thanks for asking me.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. One of the most interesting races to watch this election cycle will be the contest for Madera County District Attorney. It pits incumbent David Lynn against veteran prosecutor Sally Moreno. The race gained widespread attention late last year when allegations emerged that Lynn made racist and sexist remarks in the workplace, claims that the district attorney denies. The claims, however, were enough to generate an independent investigation at the request of the Madera County Board of Supervisors, which eventually voted unanimously to censure Lynn for his conduct and to call for his resignation. Lynn has refused that request and insists the charges are political in nature. He claims they are retaliation for his alleged investigation into purported corruption among the members of the board. So where does this leave the people of Madera County as they prepare to select their district attorney for the next 4 years? Joining us today, we have Sally Moreno, who is currently a prosecutor with the Fresno County District Attorney's Office, but worked as supervising deputy district attorney in Madera before she left that job in 2015. Sally, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
You decided you were going to run for this office before the allegations against District Attorney Lynn became public knowledge, at least. Were you surprised by what eventually came out?
No.
Why?
I worked with him. I never experienced anything personally at his hands of the type of things that were described in the independent report. But, you know, you get a sense of how somebody treats people and somebody's level of respect for people when you work for them for a little while. And so I didn't find this surprising.
Was that what motivated you to run for this position or something else?
You know, anybody who says that only one thing motivates them, I think, is not being clear. Madera deserves an excellent prosecutor. They deserve someone who's looking out for the rights of victims, someone who's focused on keeping the community safe. And they don't have that. And I have the skill set and the experience that makes me the right person for that job. So a lot of things went into that decision.
I'm sure District Attorney Lynn would disagree with that statement about his motivations. But the Madera County Deputy Sheriff's Association said in their endorsement of you, it's time for a mindset change at the DA's office. In what ways would you change the mindset there today?
Well, you know, a lot of people, you know, you watch prosecutors on TV and Law and Order and the rest of that, and it doesn't really give you a clear picture. But really, being a prosecutor is different than being any other kind of a lawyer. Being a prosecutor is about seeking justice and seeking safety for your community. It's not just about, you know, It's not just about getting the guilty verdict. It's about picking the important cases, the cases that are important for community safety, focusing on those, and making sure that the people that need to go away, go away.
So, and picking those cases, do you feel that that's not happening right now? Are cases going unprosecuted or are priorities different than what you would advocate?
Mr. Lynn has been a defense attorney in his career, and some defense attorneys make excellent prosecutors. But it takes a mindset that I don't think he's come to. He's still in the mindset of what's the fastest way to resolve this case? What's the easiest way to resolve this case? What's the way that takes the least amount of effort to resolve this? And oftentimes that results in plea bargains, which mean that, you know, gang criminals who should be doing life sentences end up doing, you know, 10 or 15 years determinant. And these days, with people getting out the way they are, those people end up back in the community, re-victimizing people. So sometimes it's not about the easy way. It's about the right way.
So with the challenges that governments face, budgetary, it's well-documented, Madera County and just about everywhere in the Valley, money doesn't grow on trees, as they say. If you're going to refocus efforts, what would potentially be cut back in order to devote attention and resources elsewhere?
Well, I don't really think we need to do that. What we have is we have a great group of young prosecutors, actually fairly experienced prosecutors in Madeira. They just need to be focused and directed so that we're not focused on plea bargaining our serious and violent felons. A lot of times what will happen is when you have a murder case where, let's say, a suspect or defendant commits a premeditated murder, that's what you charge them with. And that's a no-offers case. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to come off. There's no middle ground where you can negotiate a plea bargain in that case. So you just get ready to go to trial in that case. And those cases should be tried within about a couple of years. And that sounds like a long time, I know, to citizens. But with defense attorneys changing and evidence that needs to be investigated, you know, that's what it takes. And when we do that efficiently, if we get that violent criminal out of our community with a life without the opportunity of parole or 25 years to life, and we can count on that person staying out of our community, eventually that saves us money. We don't have to litigate again in 3 years, and again in 3 years, and again in 2 years.
You've had the opportunity now to work in Fresno County under Lisa Smitkamp, district attorney who took over a few years ago. What has that experience been like? I know you've spoken favorably of her. She is your boss, but she's a woman who leads one of the largest offices of its kind in the Valley. How has that experience informed your path forward?
In a whole host of ways. I have watched Lisa build and foster a team of prosecutors moving forward. And anybody who's, you know, played team sports knows that the team together is more than the sum of its parts. So I had the very lucky experience to work on the homicide team. And she selected me for that because she had faith in my ability to do that. But that put me in a group of what I believe are 7 or 8 of the most experienced prosecutors here in the Valley. And the opportunity to knock around with those guys, have coffee with those people, guys and gals, on a regular basis, and talk through our cases and talk about the very subtle, nuanced areas of the law has given me an opportunity to grow. And I also have had an opportunity to do some very specifically DUI murders. And that's an area where I think we really can expand the law. We can do more of that. And that's an area where we really can save lives and prevent people from being killed by drunk drivers. And we really need to focus on getting media attention on that and being ready to go to war on those cases.
Sometimes there are community rivalries throughout any region, but our Valley is one of those. I could potentially see some Madera County voters perhaps seeing your current job title with Fresno County District Attorney's Office and saying, oh, why should we elect Sally? She's from Fresno. How would you respond to someone who has that sort of concern?
Well, I'll tell you, I moved to the Madera Ranchos when I was a law student in 1990, actually 93, right after I got married, and absolutely fell in love with that community. And I have been a part of that community off and on. My career has taken me up and down the valley. I worked initially in Merced. I've also worked in Fresno, both times as a prosecutor, and I've been to the Court of Appeals. But my heart is in Madera. My kids go to school there. I was working at getting back to Madera. And I did, you know, candidly, I grew up in Fresno. I went to San Joaquin Memorial High School, but I went there with a lot of the kids that now my kids go to school with, you know, the families that generationally go along. So, and Madera is what Fresno was when I grew up there. And I'm very connected to the community. And I love the Madera community. And it's been really fun to watch all the different pieces in Madera. Madera is very original. You know, Coarse Gold is different than Oakhurst. And Coarse Gold and Oakhurst are very different than Chowchilla and Fairmead and the city of Madera. So there's a lot of very different communities. And I look forward to an opportunity to serve each and every one of them and make them more safe.
During your time in the world of criminal justice, you have seen a number of changes. It seems that California, the pendulum swings one way and then the other. In the 1990s, policies were enacted, laws were passed, tough on crime. Now criminal justice reform efforts have rolled back many of those laws and made other changes with the prison system and beyond. How have you seen those play out from your perspective?
Well, you know, it's it's always a moving target. You know, the only thing constant in all of our lives is change. And so you have to become adept and comfortable at dealing with that change. So, you know, dealing with the current changes is one of the reasons that I get back to that focus I mentioned initially. Our serious and violent felons, we really need to focus on those. We need to work cooperatively with law enforcement, make sure that they're building good cases for us and we're prosecuting those cases to the fullest extent of the law. And that's what we can do now. And we have an opportunity to do some new and different things. So in Madera, when I was there in 2014 and 2015, I helped start their behavioral health court, which takes our mentally ill population and kind of puts them back together. And again, rather than having that revolving door in and out of the criminal justice system, if we can bring resources to bear to get their medications straight, to get them the resources they need to be employed and employable and have their own residence, you know, not only do we save money, we save a life. We put those people back together. And we've done the same thing for veterans, and there are a bunch of different populations that we can look at serving in that way.
There is a mindset, there is a school of thought, rather, out there, though, amongst many in law enforcement and criminal justice, that the current set of policies, realignment, sentencing reform, et cetera, have hamstrung the efforts of local law enforcement and local district attorneys. Are you of that mindset, that the state is working against the interests of law and order with these policies, or where do you fall on that?
Well, I think it's hard to deny when you look at the statistics and the reports coming out that California is less safe than it was. But that's no excuse as a prosecutor to roll over and quit. You know, we need to work all directions. I'm proud to be working with Cal Fire and the district attorney in Sacramento to adjust the list of violent felonies to include additional arson counts. And so we are working to... I think what happened with that is people thought violent felony meant something different than it did legally. So we're working together with a bunch of agencies to adjust that and make the law mean what people thought it meant. So that's one way forward. And we have to try a lot of ways forward. Maybe it'll change in the future. I hope we will get it aligned more appropriately with what people believed it was. But again, we have to go sort of all directions at once. And that takes somebody who's hardworking and high energy, and I'm definitely those things.
The revelations that came out against District Attorney Lynn in the investigation that was commissioned by the Board of Supervisors are probably, at least in this area, in the Central Valley, the highest profile examples of what we might call the Me Too movement, at least locally. How do you think, as a woman who's working in a field that is at least historically been dominated by men, how do you feel that this current movement has played out, and how do you think it is improving the lives of women in the workforce?
That's an interesting question. My life really has been devoted to evidence and what's provable. So to a certain extent, I take issue with the Me Too movement because it doesn't require the evidentiary standard that I'm used to. I've been happily married for 24, almost 25 years. And to watch, you know, men's careers destroyed by rumor and unsubstantiated allegations, that's painful for me to watch that happen. On the flip side, women should not have to endure what they have endured. And women should feel free to come forward when they're in an environment and speak up. The truth is that sometimes there'll be a cost to that. You know, if you're a woman who's in an environment where you're being harassed, you have to weigh and balance what's going to happen. And they can say, you know, that there's no repercussions or that HR can't take any actions against you. But women know that, you know, that all of that doesn't necessarily play out in the real world again. So it's a very challenging, difficult issue. And what I really kind of retreat to is back to focused on I'm in the business of what can be proven with evidence. And if there's evidence of a crime, if there's evidence of malfeasance or misfeasance, then I'm all about eliminating that. And if it needs to be prosecuted, I'm all about prosecuting it.
Sally Moreno is a prosecutor with the Fresno County District Attorney's Office. She is a candidate for the office of Madera County District Attorney, challenging incumbent David Lynn. Sally, thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Kingsburg is one of only 10 U.S. cities to host a new traveling exhibit regarding the stories of Japanese Americans in World War II. Joining us now to tell us more about this exhibit, which is currently on display at the Kingsburg Historical Park, is David Meyer, the local curator for the Go for Broke exhibit. David, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this is something that's happening around the country, but it's in Kingsburg right now. What is the Go for Broke exhibit all about, and why is it called Go for Broke?
Go for Broke is an organization that is based in Los Angeles. However, the term comes from the famous 442nd Regiment, which was made up primarily of Japanese Americans in World War II. And that was their regimental motto, meaning that they were putting everything on the line when they went into battle. And they turned out to be one of the most decorated regiments of the entire World War II.
So tell us about this exhibit. What does it involve? This is a national project. Does it have a local flavor? And what would one expect to find?
It absolutely has a local flavor, and that was been my primary responsibility in creating the local content. I did have a little bit of input into creating the national part of the exhibition, as did all of the 10 cities in creating that. But each city gets a section of this exhibition to make their own story heard. And it's been just a fascinating project because even though I've lived in Kingsburg since 1977, I learned an awful lot that I had no clue about.
Tell us a little about that. There was a sizable, and still to this day is to some degree, but especially before the war, a sizable Japanese-American population in Kingsburg.
This is something that we've lost a little bit of because, as you say, the population of Japanese-Americans, Japanese of ancestry, has diminished considerably. And this was something that I was very interested in finding out. In 1940, the population, according to the U.S. Census, of Kingsburg was 1,504 people. And in 1940, there were three grocery stores owned by Japanese Americans. There was a noodle house. There was a Buddhist church that also had a language school to teach the Japanese language to kids. There was a Japanese labor contractor, or possibly more than one. And this was all in a town of 1,504, which traditionally was known as a Swedish village. We have pictures of every graduating class from Kingsburg High School from the beginning. And it's absolutely fascinating to look at the class pictures for 1940. We found that fully 20% of the students were Japanese American kids. And then, of course, if you go to 1943, because of Executive Order 9066, which removed all people of Japanese ancestry, there are no students of Japanese ancestry. And then thereafter, as they were released from the camps and trickled back to Kingsburg or whatever community they're going to, we have never reached the level that we were in 1940. So we apparently, based on the pictures of the high school students, I would guess that we lost about half of our Japanese American population. They never returned to Kingsburg after being interned.
So, of course, one cannot talk about the Japanese-American experience without talking about the forced internment in concentration camps of Japanese-Americans on the West Coast. So many here in this area have their own family stories with that. What in the exhibit tells that story?
Well, we've got we featured the stories from seven local families. They vary a little bit in what occurred to them. We have a the most notable person that we have involved with our exhibition is a fellow by the name of Bob Yano. And he was a soldier in the 442nd Regiment, fought in Italy, France, and other places in Europe. And he has a fascinating history to tell, and he's very good at telling it. And we have a lot of his artifacts. He hung on to an amazing collection of items, and we have his dress uniform that he's kept, and incidentally, he can still fit into it. And we have his compass and his field manuals and a number of other artifacts. Amongst them, the most interesting one is an item that is called, and I'm going to butcher the Japanese probably, but it's Seninbari. And that is a sash that a soldier would wear for protection. And it's basically just a piece of cloth. And it has on it, sewn onto it, 1,000 red dots. And usually those sashes would be made by the soldier's mother and given to the soldier when he went off to war. However, Bob and his family, when they were incarcerated in Gila River camp, his mother had gone to Japan for a visit shortly before that. And so she was not in the camp. She couldn't come back to the United States. And so the ladies that were in the camp sewed this Seninbari sash for him in the Gila River camp. And he then took that with him to war. He wore that sash through the entire war.
So this is one of only two California communities that are on the list for receiving this national exhibit, and only 10 cities nationwide. Tell us a little more about your museum. The Kingsburg Historical Society operates the historic park there just to the east of town. Tell us about that.
The historical park that is operated by the Kingsburg Historical Society is one of the least known gems of the area. It is a approximately 5-acre park with lots of green space and trees and shade, but it also contains a number of buildings that have different historical exhibitions within them, and it just goes on and on. It's very extensive display. Every time I spend any time at the park, I see stuff that I did not know existed, and I've been involved with the park for 10 years.
So if people want to see this exhibit, tell us a little more about how they can do that.
Well, the park is at 2321 Sierra Street in Kingsburg. It's very easy to find. We're going to be open from Wednesday through Sunday. Every day we're open is from 9 to 5, and there is no admission charge.
The exhibit is now through February 4th. It's called Courage and Compassion, Our Shared Story of the Japanese-American World War II Experience. The exhibit is supported by the National Park Service through a grant to the Go for Broke National Education Center, that group dedicated to educating the public on the valor of Japanese Americans during World War II. David Meyer, the local curator for the exhibit for the Kingsburg Historical Society, with us today. David, thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
And that does it for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. Send us your email, talk@kvpr.org, and subscribe to our podcast on the website. Find our audio archives there as well. kvpr.org is the web address. Also, find us online with your new smartphone app. Just search KVPR. For Valley Edition reporters, Carrie Klein, Laura Tsutsui and Christina Lopez, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.